Thanks, Shirley. Well, good afternoon. And I'm going to deal with the issue of my shirt first up because I did vow to wear my floral shirt on occasions like this. And so if you're grieving the absence of it, the reason why I'm wearing this is because my wife likes it. And I figured because I'm preaching on marriage, I thought it might be wise to wear it. This morning it was tucked in, but with you Gen Y's, I'm leaving it out, so I hope that's okay. Now look, the last couple of times I've preached up here, I've actually preached on two laments in Luke's Gospel. And so I'm happy to be actually speaking on the issue of marriage today. You can have a lot of fun with marriage. I remember hearing that a story about marriage being likened to agreeing to sleep in a room that is always too warm when you're sleeping next to a person who thinks it's always too cold. There are always challenges in marriages, aren't there? One of the ones that's well documented is men always forgetting their wedding anniversary. I heard a story about this one guy who tried to remedy that. So what he did was he went down to the local florist and he paid with his credit card in advance 5 years worth of flowers for his wife to be laid on the doorstep at each of those five anniversaries. And it was all going pretty well. Until about the third or fourth year, when he came home from work, like every other day, and he went over to his wife and he kissed her on the cheek and he put his bag back in the cupboard and he looked over and he saw some flowers. He said, "Nice flowers, darling. Who gave you those?" He'd forgotten. Well, marriage can be like that. They can be full of challenges. And it's no different for those who aren't married, the challenges that we have. Living in close quarters with people, their habits and their idiosyncrasies, they can breed in us, when we become familiar with them, a contempt. And I will say from the get-go that when we speak on from the Bible on marriage, it speaks into all relationships as a way of relating to one another. Which means, of course, that what we're going to deal with tonight is relevant to all of us. Now, when I started this morning, I thought to myself, well, why am I preaching on marriage? And you might ask that yourself. What is it that qualifies Don Bronsfield to preach on marriage? Well, I've got to say nothing in particular. Anyone can preach on marriage. You don't have to be married to speak on God's institution of marriage. In fact, the best thing to speak on when you're speaking about marriage is not to speak about marriage. It's to speak on Christ. For marriage is about the gospel. And it's not surprising then, if marriage takes its cue from the gospel, that it's not going to be well received by the world. Why? Because the gospel isn't well received by the world. In fact, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that the gospel is foolishness to the world. The idea that God would have his son die to redeem his bride, the church, well, that's an absolute nonsense to the non-Christian. And so when it comes to marriage, what it's about and who it's for, well, the world doesn't really have a clue. And we shouldn't be surprised by that, because it's hard enough for us as Christians to understand what it means and how to live it out. For fundamentally, marriage was made by God. It is his design. And secondly, and in the ultimate sense, marriage is for God. That is to say, it is to bring him pleasure and to make him look good. It is his design. That's the most fundamental thing. And the ultimate purpose of marriage is to display his glory. We are to showcase or display the glory of God by the way we relate in our marriages. It is the blueprint for the way we are to relate in every relationship. And we do that in our marriages by modelling the covenant relationship between Christ and the church. The pattern of Christ and the church is the model for marriage. And that is an impossible thing to understand without first having understood the mystery of Christ and the church. See, marriage is God's design, not man's, and so it's not surprising when it's left up to us to work it out. We'll get it wrong every time. So much so that we can even say that it's not limited to being between a man and a woman. Same-sex marriage is vehemently defended by its advocates today. And these are sensitive issues, and they're important ones. And the Bible is abundantly clear on them. But rather than speak on what marriage isn't today, my job is to speak on what it is. And you might want to keep your Bibles open there, and we can perhaps put that first passage up on the screen there. Genesis chapter 2, There we see in that passage that marriage is the doing of God. It is his design. After creating his good world, God breathes into the man, right, who is to take stewardship of the garden. But there is something wrong. The only not good in the creation account. Notice there in verse 18, God says, it is not good for the man to be alone. So, because of that, he forms out of the dust all the beasts of the fields and the birds of the air, and he brings them to Adam, and he says, well, what are you going to call them? And so Adam looks at one, he says, well, that one looks like a pig, so pig. That one looks like a goat, so goat. Giraffe, axolotl, budgie, whatever it might be. Notice, though, still no suitable helper there for Adam. None of them do it for him. So Adam is put into a sleep. He loses a rib and he gains a mate. And now he says, now this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And she should we call woman. But the first thing to notice here is that it is God who decrees that it is not good for a man to be alone. It is his doing to make for the man a suitable helper, to make them male and female. It is his design. That is the first thing. And secondly, and this can easily go unnoticed, there in verse 22 of chapter 2, God is the first father of the bride. He brings the woman to the man, but the point is the same. Marriage is God's initiative. That's the second thing in the string of the cord of the design of marriage. Thirdly, it is God's intention in creating the man and the woman that they would leave and cleave and become one flesh. That is to say that they are to leave their mum and dad and that they are to cleave to their spouse and become one flesh, to form their own inseparable union, which is both a sign and an expression by the way of sexual intercourse, through sexual intimacy. Now, I remember hearing a story about some parents of their newly wedded daughter. They got a phone call from her on her wedding night. As she was speaking to her dad, evidently she'd had her first, or they'd had their first argument as husband and wife. And when she was on the phone to her dad, she asked, "Dad, can I come home?" And the mother's listening to this intently as he's relaying it back, and he says, and she said, "What did you say?" And he said, "I told her that she was home." See, when you marry, you leave and you commit yourself to each other for better, for worse, richer, for poorer, sickness or health, until death divides you. God designed it this way. It is his doing. In fact, when you get to Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 9, verse 8 and 9, where Jesus, like so many times, is challenged by the Pharisees, in this case on the issue of marriage and the provision that Moses gave of divorce back there in the Old Testament. And God says, no, that was because of the rampant disobedience of the people and to set about some kind of order. And then he says, therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. See, when two people get married, it is not the couple, it is not the people in the congregation or in the hearing of a ceremony, it is not the celebrant or the minister who joins that couple together. It is God. Period. The point being that marriage is the doing of God. It is the most fundamental truth about marriage. God is the designer. He presents the woman to the man and he gives her away for the purposes of creating the family unit. He brought the woman to the man for the purposes of marriage. Well, not only is marriage the doing of God, but it is also for the display of God. By that I mean it emulates or reveals something about the way in which God relates. God entered into a covenant or an agreement with Adam and Eve. And when we marry, we too enter into promises with one another. We make a commitment to one another. Our end of the deal with God in the garden is don't eat from this tree, or else instead of living forever, you won't. It's a simple covenant agreement. In marriage, it is stay together, come what may, sick, poor, healthy, rich. Circumstances are irrelevant. Stay together. It's done. Now, of course, we need to be sensible and sensitive here and wise. There are, of course, circumstances where a separation with a view to reconciliation are appropriate. And I'm thinking of circumstances like infidelity or assault or some kind of abuse, those kind of things, some kind of addiction. But when it comes to marriage, we're meant to stay together. There is no provision in the Bible for a policy of no-fault divorce. that was instituted in our country back in the mid-70s, and we are still reaping what we've sown in regard to that. And in fact, we will reap what we sow in relation to what we're putting in the marriage now, in relation to gender redefining and same-sex marriages. Well, in chapter 2, it is a good world in the garden with the covenant between God and mankind and between the man and the woman in place. But what happens next? In the next chapter, Genesis 3 changes the relationship in both these covenants forever. We broke the covenant with God, and with it, the beautiful, trustworthy security of marriage has been broken and disappears forever. The day we declared our independence from our God in our desire to be like him, to know good from evil, it changed everything. Notice there in verse 25 of our passage, the man and his wife were naked, but they felt no shame. Now suddenly, after breaking covenant with God, eating from the tree they're not supposed to, they suddenly realise they're naked in chapter 3, verse 7. See, that's what happens when we decide what's good and evil. We're not supposed to play God. We're supposed to humble ourselves and listen to him. See, they failed to heed God, and now they think they can hide from God. Sin has corrupted them so that they now think they can elude God. See, that's the problem with sin. It weaves a web of deceit. But the important thing to notice here is that both the man and the woman now feel naked and ashamed in Genesis 3. The trustworthy security of marriage has been corrupted. The foundational covenant keeping between God and man was broken, and with it, the foundation of the marriage covenant is shattered. And two consequences are felt straight away. My partner is no longer trustworthy, viewing my nakedness. And secondly, I feel guilty. I feel guilty with God, and I feel vulnerable and unworthy around my partner. See, Eve wanted her independence. She is now central and selfish. She will put herself first. She is no longer a servant. She is no longer safe, and she doesn't feel secure. And the same goes for Adam. They feel vulnerable around one another, and they can't trust each other anymore with that covenant-keeping love. There is now a temptation for Adam to dominate his wife and to abdicate his responsibilities as the head of the home. And there's a temptation for Eve to resent him and to take over his job and even to skew what they're meant to be doing. And what's more, they feel guilty. They feel guilty because they've broken the covenant with God, and so they hide from God. They try to hide from God. You can't hide from God. And so they sew fig leaves together. They try to cover up. Notice here they try to cover up to conceal. Now, there are grounds for covering up here, but it's not to conceal. There are grounds for covering up because God covers them up later on with some superior animal skins. But the clothing that was given to Adam and Eve and that's given to us is to confess, not to conceal. Well, to confess what? Well, to confess that we have broken the covenant with God and things aren't as they ought to be, that the good world that God has made is now crumbling around us. And every thorn and every thistle is a reminder that we are living outside the garden. It was never intended to be that way. And our nakedness, and therefore our need for clothing, is a reminder to us that our relationships are now broken. And it's worth noting here at this point, and I speak mainly to the ladies in our congregation on this, that clothes cover parts to detract attention from what they cover. Very unhelpful for men. So that what is left are hands that are eager to serve, feet that are swift to bring the good news, and a face that is to reflect the goodness and the glory of God. I say that just as an aside here, because the important thing to notice here is that our clothing is a confession that we have declared our independence from God. When all appears lost and broken, see, God does not give up on his purposes for the world. It is still his world. He is still the good and loving King. That hasn't changed. What has changed is that men and women and all that's placed under them is now in decay, the earth and everything in it, including you and I. But there from Genesis 3 and the rest of the Bible, God sets about restoring what has been broken. God's clothing of Adam and Eve points to this, that in his mercy, one day, he is going to deal with our nakedness entirely. But it comes at a cost. Notice that in clothing Adam and Eve there is the shedding of blood of those animals. To deal with their nakedness comes at a cost. So what is marriage meant to look like in this broken world? The account in Genesis 2 read earlier, well, that's before the fall. That covenant's now broken. Well, the simple answer to that is it's meant to look like the new covenant. I mentioned before that reference to leaving and cleaving in verse 24 points beyond itself. It points beyond itself to Jesus, who leaves his Father in heaven and clings to his bride. But it comes at a great cost. It comes at the cost of him passing over his bride's sin. I've got to say, marriage looks exactly like that. In fact, it looks exactly like Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians 5, that is the most probably familiar and red-letter verse, passage, on what relating in marriage is meant to look like. Now, it's not my job to speak on that today, and I won't be, but I refer to it simply as the ultimate aim in marriage, namely that a husband and wife are to emulate the relationship between Christ and the church. That is, they are to display what God is like, that wonderful relationship between Christ, who dies for his bride, the church, who in turn lives and gives herself wholeheartedly back to Christ, is to be the model for the way in which we are to relate woman to man and man to woman in marriage. That's what it's meant to look like, with the ultimate purpose of displaying God's wisdom, to bring him glory. That's what marriage is. That's what it's ultimately for, to make God look good. Well, you might say to that, well, how do I do that? How do I model Christ in the church in my marriage if marriage is primarily a display of covenant keeping? How do I do that when I'm predisposed to being self-centred and feeling guilty and naked and vulnerable around my partner and guilty with God and with one another? Well, the simple answer to that is to preach the gospel to ourselves. I mentioned before that to preach on marriage is to preach the gospel. And so when you come to your passage now in Colossians chapter 3, there just before that, Paul has already laid the high foundation of the person and work of Christ for our sins, namely that he has passed over our sin. He does not hold our sin against us. That is the foundation of all of life and therefore of marriage. In fact, it's true of all relationships. The main battle in life and therefore in marriage is to believe in the person and work of Christ, that he is supreme. He has the credentials to cancel our sin, our debt that is mounting every day. He can deal with it. He's dealt with it. If only we would believe him. And there, before our passage in Colossians 2, verse 13, Paul says that while we were still dead in our sins, he forgave our offences. And therefore, because he's passed over our sin, he can now call us chosen, holy, loved. That's what he says in Colossians chapter 3, verse 12. While we were yet sinners, while we were God-haters, he loved us, he chose us, and he set us apart. See, that is the good news, people, for those of us who trust in Jesus. And it is the covenant-keeping display of God through Christ that we are to mirror in our marriages. See, marriage is not about love or romance at its root. It is about covenant-keeping. God passes over our sin, not because we're lovable, but because he made a promise to love us. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he once said, it is covenant keeping that sustains love, not love and romance that sustains covenant keeping. You know, Paul reminds us at the end of chapter 3, when he makes a conclusion about what human nature is like, he says that amongst us there is no one righteous, not even one. Our throats are like open graves. The poison of vipers is on our lips. There is no one who does good, not even one. Our mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Friends, that is not lovable. Christ had to die because of that. Sin is ugly. Christ had to pay for that to redeem his bride, and the dowry was his blood. And the way we are to keep the marriage covenant is the same. Look at verse 13 of chapter 3, Colossians. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. God's new covenant is a covenant of grace. Therefore, the way we are to relate husband to wife and wife to husband is not to hold sin against one another. See, when we dig into the resources of Christ, when we preach the gospel to ourselves, the sin, the blood, God passing over our sin, when we consider his love in choosing us to set us aside to be partakers of his covenant, display his glory, that ought to move us to clothe ourselves with compassion. By that, we mean adorn ourselves, wear it, breathe it. Because when we clothe ourselves with compassion, we're going to be kind to one another. Compassion is the attitude, kindness is the action. And there's two others. See, when we reflect on the covenant grace shown to us in Christ, it'll cause us to clothe ourselves with humbleness. And when we're humble, we will be gentle with one another. Humility is the attitude. Gentleness is the action. Never any more gentle than God has been with us and continues to be with us. And reflecting on Christ's covenant grace and his patience with us, in spite of us continually getting up his nose, frustrating him, doing the wrong thing. See, that provides a resource for us to clothe ourselves with patience. And when we're patient with one another, notice there, we will forbear the things that continually get up our noses, and we will have the grace to forgive what grievances we have. That's what marriage is supposed to look like. Full of grace, not counting sin against one another, not keeping a record of wrongs, rather serving one another, even in the face of blatant wrongdoing towards one another. That is the covenant love Christ shows us. And that's how we're meant to relate in our marriages and in all our other relationships. See, if we fail to meditate on the gospel, if the word of Christ doesn't dwell in us richly, if we're not taken captive by the covenant grace that Jesus shows us, our spouse will pay for it. The people around us will pay for it. See, Kelly pays for it. When I don't reflect hard enough to remember that my mounting debt has been covered by the cost of Christ's blood, we become like that man in the parable of the immerciful servant. Though he's been forgiven an insurmountable sum that he could never repay, goes off and hits his mate up who owes him a few bucks. See, that's what happens, friends, when we fail to preach the gospel to ourselves. Preaching the gospel to ourselves saves our marriages. It saves relationships. You know, I remember hearing about a couple who'd been married for 15 years. They had more than their usual disagreements, and they wanted their marriage to work. So they agreed on an idea that wife had. For a period of a month, they planned to drop a slip in a fault box. The boxes would provide a place to let the other know about their daily irritations. The wife was diligent in her efforts, leaving the towels on the floor again, not mowing the lawn, not taking the bins out on and on until the end of the month. And after dinner, at the end of that month, they exchanged boxes. The husband reflected on what he'd done wrong. When the wife opened her box, she noticed on every slip it had the same message. On 30 slips were the same message. I love you. I love you. I love you. That is covenant grace. See, Paul would not say forbear and forgive each other if things in our marriage weren't going to push us to the brink. They will and they do. And if we don't draw on the covenant grace or consider the patience of Christ, we're going to overheat and we're going to be unable to forbear and forgive. You know, on her golden wedding anniversary, her grandmother revealed the secret of her long and happy marriage. On her wedding day, she said, I made a decision to allow 10 of my husband's faults just to go unnoticed for the sake of my marriage. And some people ask, well, what were some of the faults? And she said, well, you know what, I never did get round to writing them down. But whenever my husband did something that made me hopping mad, I would simply say to myself, lucky for him, that's one of the 10. See, overlooking sin, not counting sin, passing over sin, that is something that is wonderful. It showcases the love of God and it makes God look magnificent. And if you think that it is boring or unromantic to have a dynamic of selfless, costly service in marriage as its bedrock, then it's possible for you that the gospel of Christ isn't something to be marvelled at. Jesus, who pours out his blood for you to cleanse you to be his bride, is just foolishness to the world. Is it foolishness to you? See, why am I talking about unconditional servanthood, forgiving and forbearing, and not about love and romance? It's not disqualifying the fact that we should be spontaneous and so reckless at times with our spouse to woo each other and wow each other and to excite one another and to build that romance in our relationship. The Bible's not saying that, and neither am I. The truth is, when the trouble comes in your marriage, and it's coming, God knew it, Paul preached it. I'm telling you, if you don't have the covenant of grace as your bedrock, how are you going to fight when your marriage, in your marriage, when it going gets tough? You won't be able to fight with that Hollywood contaminated, romance intoxicated, little tricks on how to keep your marriage alive in books like Cleo and Cosmopolitan. They're full of selfishness, full of shallow and empty philosophies that ultimately lead to discontentment and an insatiable desire to find a relationship that doesn't even exist. You know, one of the most wonderful things about working with a Christian man is that we get to fellowship. And I had a conversation with Damien this week, and he told me a story about a couple, a married couple evidently. Now, this could be an urban myth or it could be real, but I think it makes a point. They both were having sordid internet affairs. And it got to the point where they decided, unbeknown to one another, that they were going to meet with their respective partners. And when they did, they actually found out that it was each other that they were dating. But I think it tells you something. If you don't invest in the covenant and you put all your effort into romance, that's what happens. And that's why Paul says, hang in there with one another. Forgive one another. Let the peace of Christ rule your hearts. Don't be fooled. It's hard to love one another. Left to ourselves, we are not lovable. Not to acknowledge that we are not lovable is really saying that Jesus didn't have to go to the cross. I'll say it again. Not to acknowledge that it is hard to love each other is like saying that Jesus didn't have to go to the cross. It is tough work to love one another, because it is sin-forbearing, sin-forgiving work. You know, one of the most wonderful fruits of forgiving and forbearing is that it actually becomes attractive. Sacrificial love is a love that lasts. The more we forbear and encourage each other, the better our spouse becomes. It can be the reawakening of affections. It ignites passions that you thought were maybe lost, but they were just sitting there dormant. See, the higher the price we pay as a dowry, by emulating the covenant of Christ in our relationships, the more valuable and the more wonderful our bride or our spouse becomes. Jesus paid the ultimate price, and so now he can call us chosen, holy, loved. That's what makes us valuable to him, the infinite worth of his blood. And we're called to model that in our marriage. I don't know if you've ever heard the story of Johnny Lingo's eight-cow wife. Johnny lived on the island of Kiniwata in the South Pacific. He was renowned for being a skilled and savvy negotiator, Many sought his services when they wanted to cut a deal. I'll tell you what, he lost a fair bit of credibility, though, when he went to seek out a wife from the mainland. Evidently, the going dowry for a wife back in those days were 2 to 3 cows. Sounds a bit uncharitable. Probably 4 for top shelf, right? Well, Johnny paid 8. What made the story more extraordinary was that the girl he chose to be charitable was less than average. She was dour and homely, insignificant looking. She was skinny and awkward. She walked with hunched shoulders and a stooped head. When Johnny offered 8 cows to her dad, that bloke thought he hit the jackpot. A few years later, a friend from the mainland visited the couple. When he arrived, Sarita, Johnny's wife, didn't seem to be around, but a more beautiful girl was there. But his friend soon learned that it was actually Sarita. He couldn't believe the transformation. The tilt of her shoulders, the lift of her chin, the sparkle in her eyes that spelt inner peace and self-confidence, not pride. And so he asked Johnny, "What's doing? What happened?" And he said, "Imagine what our wives must think of us, or think of themselves, when we pay such a low dowry for them. I wanted an 8-cow wife, and that's what I paid. And that's how she views herself now." See, men, how much are you paying for your wives? Jesus paid with his blood so that we could be called chosen, holy, loved. No charge can be laid upon us. Men, we are called to crucify ourselves, so it's no longer us, but Christ living in us. That's how we're called to love our wives and to keep the covenant and to showcase the brilliance and the glory of God, being like him. Cherish your wife. Cultivate the value in her. It makes God look good in the process, and that's what marriage is for. See, young unmarrieds, take note. If you don't have the gospel, the covenant grace as your bedrock foundation of the one you set about to court or marry, you're going to make it so much more difficult for yourself. You know, I had a conversation with a guy this morning down in the morning congregation. He was telling me when he was a younger Christian, he had a conversation with a minister, and he said, "Is marriage like, you know, if I give 50% and my wife gives 50%, that equals 100%? He goes, "No." He says, "You give 100% and you expect nothing in return, because that's exactly what Jesus has done." And if you're here today and you're married to a non-Christian or you're in a situation like that, take heart. God has resourced us so that we can give 100% in that situation. Well, as we come to a close, it would be remiss of me not to consider Paul's words to husbands and wives at the end of our passage, verses 18 and 19. There he says, "Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting to the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and don't be harsh with them." See, having different roles as equals is in no way demeaning. We see it modelled clearly in the Godhead, don't we? Jesus, who is no less God, submits to his Father. He doesn't see equality with his Father, something to lay hold of, but no, he takes on the very nature of a servant so that he can bring glory to the Father, who then exhorts Jesus to his right-hand side to be ruler and judge with him. And the Spirit of Christ is always on about Jesus, nothing else, not himself. They're all equal, but they're all different. Different roles to fulfill the purpose of restoring his bride back to himself. Not surprisingly then, a man and a woman, though equal, are given different roles in a marriage relationship. You know, Campbell King, I reckon he said this to me, countless number of times. He said, "If you don't ever come to grips with the fact that a man and a woman are fundamentally different, you will go nowhere in your marriage." I remember going out after a church service, speaking to a minister who was trying to tell me that a man and a woman are basically the same. I said, "So you're trying to tell me that a man and a woman are the same except for body parts?" He goes, "Yeah, that's right." And so I looked at his wife, who was standing behind him. Looked like she had a fresh perm. She had earrings on, a necklace. She had a handbag over her shoulder. She was wearing a blouse and a skirt and high heels. And I thought to myself, why isn't he wearing any of that? I'll tell you why, because he's different. See, husbands. Husbands, see, we can naturally abuse our strength to be overbearing and harsh with our wives and harsh with our children. See, men are meant to be strong. But we're meant to be strong, to be tender, to be loving, and to take initiative, not to leave it to the wives. That's what contributed to the breaking of the covenant in the first place. We just sat back and let it happen. Husbands, take initiative. Die to yourself and put your wives and your family first. Wives, help your husbands do this, because we're weak and stupid in areas that you are strong and things that you're designed for. We need your support. Don't pick on our faults and try and do our job. It's our job. Even if you can do it better than us, that's not the point. It's our job. See, my wife's smarter than me, but that's not the point. And I know that Dave's wife's smarter than him, but that's not the point either. Well, just in closing then, see, marriage, it is God's design. It is his doing. That is the fundamental truth about marriage. The ultimate truth is that it is meant to showcase the glory of God, to emulate his covenant of grace. How do we do that? Well, let's finish with Paul's words on that issue, verses 12 and 13. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion so that you'll be kind. Clothe yourselves with humility so you'll be gentle. Clothe yourselves with patience so you'll be able to bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have with one another. Forgive as the Lord has forgiven you.